This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds.
Engage.
Engage. Kirk Enterprise. Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes. Fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage. Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. I am your host, Jordan Hoffman, and it is such a pleasure to speak to you this week. We are launching these episodes during Anniversary Week, and it's a little bit fun. It's a lot fun. Are you kidding me? To be a Star Trek fan right now, there's a lot happening. We're on the cover of every paper, every magazine. Go to an airport. We're all over the place. There's special episodes of television on Smithsonian Channel, CBS Morning Show, you name it. And there's a massive takeover of all your social media streams. Star Trek is everywhere. But for you and I, Star Trek has already been everywhere. And Star Trek will continue to be everywhere. Certainly up through next January, when the new show, Star Trek Discovery, hits CBS All Access. And as we go to sleep at night, nestled with Star Trek novels and comic books underneath our pillow. It's a wonderful time to snuggle up with a stuffed Mugatu in addition to a loved one. All right, so what's going on? Today's episode is special. What I plan to do is launch this on the actual day, September 8th, 2016, 50 years to the day that The Man Trap, the first ever episode of Star Trek that aired to the public, showed on American television. I recently learned, and maybe I should have known this earlier, that it showed on Canadian television a few days earlier. But we love you, Canadians, but USA, USA. Now, to that end, I just want to jump to it. We have an interview with two very important people, Bijo and John Trimble. And there's not really too much to set up because the three of us discuss it. But I just want to let you know where we did the interview. It was a few weeks ago, and it was at the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas. And, you know, the Trimbles go to as many conventions as they can, but they don't go to all of them. They are not young people. And they are, and they say it as much in the episode, they are not particularly solvent and flush people. They are happy in their retirement, but, you know, there isn't big money in being the number one Star Trek fan. So it was great that they were able to make it there, that the convention sent them out there. And it was also great because while I was speaking with them, they did not know that they were going to be honored with a special thank you, thanks to our friend John Van Sitters of CBS, who we've interviewed on the show before, had commissioned J.K. Woodward, the artist, who I've also interviewed on the show before, to do a special drawing for them for all their work. And if you go to the Google machine and type in J.K. Woodward, Bijo Trimble, artwork, convention, throw in a few other keywords, you'll find it. It's really very sweet. Now, it's possible, it's entirely possible that you're listening to this. One of my friends, if you're one of my listeners out there in the world, by the way, I recently met my first Serbian listener who was in New York, and he gave me a wonderful gift. So his name was Miloš. If you're listening, Miloš, I love you. And I've met now, and I had a Brazilian listener contact me. So I think it's terrific how many international listeners. But if you're you know, on the subway here in New York, or if you're on the 405 in Los Angeles, or if you're anywhere else in between, and you're thinking, okay, cool, another episode of Engage. I'm afraid to admit it, but I'm going to. Who the hell's Bijo Trimble? Who the hell's John Trimble? They were the ones during the second half of the second season of Star Trek when it became pretty evident that NBC was going to cancel the show. They prevented it from happening. They did. They did. Nobody else did. John and Bijo Trimble, specifically Bijo, made it happen. They are two wonderful individuals that are just fans who had the gumption to say, nobody's going to do it if we don't do it. They got Star Trek renewed. They saved it. They got it its third season, and it was the third season of Star Trek, which I will readily admit is not the best season of Star Trek, although there are some real winners in there. Enterprise Incident, for God's sakes. Day of the Dove, for God's sakes, and a number of others. They got the third season. If there was no third season, Star Trek would not have had the life in syndication that it had. Episodes may have floated around here and there in various channels, but it would not have been ubiquitous in the 1970s into the 1980s. It would not have been ubiquitous enough to maintain a fan base and get that animated series going. And that animated series stoked the flames of the reruns to get Star Trek the Motion Picture happening in 1979. Bijo and John Trimble are as important to the legacy of Star Trek as Gene Roddenberry and William Shatner themselves. Boom! I just threw the mic down here. Now, what's also great is that they're wonderful people, and you're going to hear it yourselves. So enough of my yapping. Let's go back now a few weeks and listen to my interview with Bijo and John, two wonderful, and Bijo she's kind of the star of the show. I mean, John takes a backseat because she's feisty and vivacious, and she's 80-something years old with a shock of pink hair. It's a lot of fun with her. So listen to this interview and celebrate 50 years of Star Trek with two of the most important people in the entire franchise.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
Official Star Trek podcast with your host Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
Good morning, everybody. It's now day two of the Star Trek convention here in Las Vegas, and I have some. I can't state it enough. Very esteemed guests, important guests, and it takes a village to make a franchise like Star Trek. But if it were not for the two people that I'm with today, I wouldn't be here right now. You can't put too fine a point on this. Star Trek, as we know it right now, would not exist if it was not for John and Bijo Trimble. Because, really, the show was going to be canceled after 2 years. And it took these two people to say, wait, we really like this show. Let's see if we can, as fans, get it to go to a third season. And that third season, which, by the way, was not the best season.
No responsibility for the third season. Right. But because it had three seasons, it went into syndication.
Right. That was the thing. That was the threshold that it passed. And it said, aha, it now has a number that means we can chop this up and we can ship it out. and it can play on late night TV and Sunday mornings and all across the country, across the globe, forever and ever. So that enough people would continue to watch it, there would be an animated series, and there would eventually be a motion picture. And now we have a new series starting in January, all these years later. We have movies in the theater right now. And like I say, I don't want to give you too much credit. I mean, it takes a village, like I say. Yeah. But there has to be, for every battle, there has to be a first one on the field flying the flag. So I want to say, personally, thank you very much for the work you did, because Star Trek has meant a lot to me, has gotten me through some bad times. I mean, I'm, an upbeat guy most of the time, but when things get you down, you can go, well, I'm going to watch an episode of Star Trek, and that's going to take my mind off of the stuff that's bothering me, or I'm going to read a Star Trek book, or I'm just going to sit in my room
and think about Spock.
There you go.
You know, I'm just going to sit and think about Spock instead of the garbage that's happening in my life right now, and it's going to help out. So
it works.
Awesome. So for people who may not know the story, let's go back in time a little bit.
All right.
It's 1967. And season two has concluded. And up till this point...
Well,
no, it hadn't concluded yet.
It hadn't quite concluded. Okay. We had, through meeting Gene Roddenberry before Star Trek at the Worldcon in 66, we'd gotten to know him, and we'd sort of done him a favor there by getting some costumes that he'd brought into a fashion show she was running. So... Gene said, well, if you're ever in Hollywood, call me and we'll do lunch. Now, that's a standard gambit.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out he really meant it.
But just to back it up, were you working in Hollywood at all?
No.
You were just fans. You're just super fans. Like when we see them today.
Well, yeah, we weren't what we would call super fans, maybe, because we were all full grown and we had two kids.
Right.
And you know, in those days, that meant a lot too.
We were active in science fiction fandom, and with the science fiction conventions, with fanzines, with a whole bunch of stuff that predates Star Trek.
Sure.
And it was at this World Science Fiction Convention where Gene had brought three episodes of this new show to show to fans at the urging of several writers, and had brought three costumes that he'd hired models to wear at the thing to kind of intrigue fans. And
now, this is about 10 days before Star Trek actually aired.
Right, so we're talking late August of 1966.
Mm, yeah.
So Bijou had been told with this science fiction and fantasy art show, fashion show, that she had exactly 1 hour,
okay.
No more. And she had like, how many, 20?
20 costumes.
And
which is a lot for, you know, to have amateur models.
Sure, yeah.
And then they come back to her and tell her, well, we promised this big Hollywood producer who's here that we can put three of his costumes in your fashion show. And she said, I'm barely going to get the models on and off the stage in an hour with what I've got.
Right.
Go on promising. And about what, how long?
Well, it was about 20 minutes later. Then I had this tall, good-looking man say, you know, saying, can I talk to you for a little while? My name is Gene Roddenberry.
And we'd never heard of it.
Right.
And
right.
I said, sure, good for a cup of coffee, let's go. And so it was time to take a break on the practice anyway. And I, you know, after we went to the coffee shop, and a few minutes later, that silver-tongued devil had talked his way into my fashion show. But the girls, seeing a holiday weekend job go down the drain, had offered to help with the fashion show, you know, be backstage starters and so on. And so the models were actually very responsible for helping run that. Well, Gene was grateful and, as I say, invited us anytime we came down from over.
Right, so he's like, oh, you two guys helped us out because that first convention, you're just building buzz for the new show.
Right.
And let's not underplay it. The costumes were a big selling point for that show.
Well, he brought two Mudd's Women costumes. Whoa. And the cute little crossover jumper from what are little girls made of?
Oh, Andrea's outfit?
Yes, yes.
That is the sexiest outfit in all 50 years of Star Trek.
Almost, yes, I'll tell you. And so he had found a tiny model that would fit that costume, and she looked dynamite. And when she walked through the convention floor, you could just hear all of the male eyes going click, 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 watching her. And they were fun. The models were actually really fun people to be around, and that made it all the better.
So, all right, so you knew the guy, and then, so you became friendly, and then the show goes on the air, and you're immediately hooked.
Oh, yeah.
And you're connected with other fans because you're already involved in fanzines and science fiction conventions. So you'd been in communication with other super fans.
Yeah.
And then by the middle of the second season, you start hearing the rumblings that even though the show is doing well in the ratings, well, there are conspiracy theorists about why the show was canceled, but there were rumblings that NBC wanted to pull the plug.
Yes, they did.
And that's when you guys sprung to action.
NBC first wasn't happy about getting the show. You know, Lucille Ball was the person who had her studio, Desilu, sponsor, I mean, put on.
Bankroll.
It was sort of an independent production that was then sold to NBC. And
NBC executives, first they had a meeting with Gene and they realized here's a loose cannon.
Right.
He is going to do weird things and we are very mundane people. We don't want weird things.
Right.
And so right away it was off to a bad start. And then NBC kind of did all the little tricks they could to kill off the show. And the show was actually in danger in the first season.
Right.
And Harlan Ellison and a couple of people, other writers, spearheaded a letter writing campaign, but they only asked a few fans and then the writers, which, you know, basically said, this is the only show that is hiring actual writers to do the story. And if it goes away, science fiction, you know, and then... If it goes away, there goes some really good jobs. But unfortunately, the appeal at that time was very, very limited.
Yeah.
And
my understanding also is that even though the ratings were good, it was just a very, very expensive show to make.
Well, of course.
So the profit margins were not
high. As a matter of fact, that's what caused Lucy to sell Desilu to Paramount, was the fact that they couldn't afford to produce the show any longer.
Right. It was also at the same time as Mission Impossible. It was a double. They had done two big bets.
Yeah.
And both of the shows were doing well, but part of the reason they were doing well is that they were expensive. You know,
they were expensive shows to do.
And everything had to be done, remember, by hand, not by computers.
They didn't have
computers at that time. And so the result was that if you had something happening on an alien planet or with, you know, you would have little puppets or you would have, you know, a lot of stop action going on. And all of this is expensive. Nowadays,
Baylock's ship took half a year to create, and now it's a little yellow dot on a thing. Right?
I just love that. I mean, to me, the new technology is utterly amazing.
But there is something to be said about the handmade stuff.
You know,
there's a quality to it.
I mean, if you ever get a chance to see George Pal's puppet tunes that he put out during World War II in Germany.
And before, well, no, and before World
before,
War
well,
II,
yeah.
After Hitler had come to power, there were some puppetoons that really cut into...
These were all stop-action animation. Claymation is the closest I can describe it. And by the way, all the Nazis were depicted as nuts and bolts.
Oh.
Anyway, and he had to leave Germany because he got word that he was going to be...
arrested.
Yeah, there's a lot of that early. Do you know the Czech animator Karel Zeman?
Or Zelman?
He also did some amazing stuff, you know, decades earlier than anything was happening here. And Hollywood took for his ideas. They're like, we're gonna. That's a good idea that he's creative. And because it was in Czechoslovakia at the time, they had no money at all. So it was all he came up with these ideas.
Amazing.
And,
well, George Pal was doing this in a friend's basement.
Wow.
The little stop action things, and he escaped Germany. And came to the United States, and at that time was just told, well, the puppetoons won't fly. They're just, you know, because they're too topical.
Yeah.
And then he went into doing the movies that he's famous for.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So wait, let's get back now to second season of Star Trek.
Right.
Okay.
You're starting, because you're connected to other people who know people who have their ears to the ground. Oh, I know a guy who works production in this. Oh, he helps out with the special effects.
Well, actually, we were on the set of... watching them film one of the climactic parts of The Deadly Years.
Oh.
And it's the scene where Shatner is back. He's back to the younger Shatner from the aged one. And he jumps down off the upper part of the bridge down to where the command chair is and then grabs his back so that there's kind of a twinge from having been the aged person.
Right, yeah.
And... the director made him do it about 6 or 7 times. I think, you know, claiming that it wasn't quite right.
Okay.
You know, I think actually what he was doing was tweaking Shatner. But in any case, we noticed that the whole atmosphere on the set was different than we'd seen other times we'd been watching there.
So this was not your first time on the set?
No. Oh, no, we'd been on the set several times.
Yeah. It was a very down crew at this time.
Yeah.
And we thought, God, there's a whole difference here. So we asked around for a little bit. And
no one wanted to talk about it.
So we did what you do when you really want to know what's going on. You went over to Craft Services.
This is the guy who brings the coffee and donuts
to
the set.
Yeah.
And they are kind of the radar O'Reillys of the movie business.
Because they
find out all the gossip.
Yeah.
Everybody needs a cup of coffee.
They know what's going on before anybody else does. And the guy at Craft Services, he said, it's not official yet, but the words come down that it's probably going to be canceled at the end of this season.
Mm.
So we had to leave because we still lived in Oakland at the time. And we're driving up the Central Valley and we're talking about this and how it was such a difference and what have you. And that if the show was going to be canceled, that would really be disappointing.
Yeah.
And I turned to her and I said, there ought to be something we could do about that.
Right. For a minute you were down, but then you heard the trumpets blare.
Well, this man should know better than to, lay a glove like that in front of me, and I said, yes, they ought to be something. So then
we spent the rest of the trip formulating what we could do.
Battle plan.
And this was, by the way, completely new because nobody had ever done this.
When TV shows would come and go, and that was it. You ate what you were fed.
And this was the first time
that fans would say, no, we demand more of this.
Well, there were certainly fans out there who wrote their individual letters, and shot off snarky letters to the networks or the studio about this. But no, it hadn't been organized. And we knew it had to be organized. Now, this is before computers, and this is before cheap photocopy printing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we were up against it. It's hard to explain to the kids today because bless their hearts, we say this, we did it before computers, and one youngster says, you didn't even have a laptop?
So we formulated the outlines of what we were going to do, and then we got back to Oakland, we said, well, we'd better phone Gene and find out if he's actually thrown in the towel or if he's trying to keep the show going.
Yeah.
And so we phoned down, and Gene came on the line, and he told us, that he had just had a staff meeting saying if there was only some way we'd contact the fans, and we fell on his lap.
All right.
Now, was this exactly that dramatically true? We don't know. After all, Gene was a storyteller, right? And he was a good one. But he always sounded sincere. So what? There may have been a time lapse in there, but I'm sure it actually happened. Because the studio kept thinking, well, we know there are lots of fans out there, but how do we reach them?
Right. It was a different era.
We knew how to do that.
So you then went to your index cards and your Rolodex?
What we did was we formulated this letter that gave points that things to say, things not to do.
Mm.
And then at the end of it, we said, what we want you to do is write a letter, copy this information, give it or send it to 10 friends and ask each of them to write a letter and copy this and send it out to their friends. And
so it was the power of 10.
Power of 10, yeah.
And it worked. We also got
Do you have an estimate of how many people actually sent in as a result of this?
No, really, because, well.
Okay. A young man came to Gene after the renewal and, it was third season was going on, and claimed that he'd worked for a computer company that NBC had to send the letters out to actually do something with computers.
Really?
And that there were 1 million letters.
Whoa!
Now,
we're not sure of that.
It's a nice round number.
Oh, I love that. We love the numbers.
Was that true, or was he just putting Gene on to try and get a job with him?
Right.
Yeah, we can't. And of course, NBC never told us. They wouldn't tell us anything.
Right. So, but it was enough. It clearly was. Obviously, it was not just 135.
Well, later on, we met a NBC executive on the Paramount lot, and he said, "Well, we only got 10,000 letters," and my reply was, "If fandom can change a network's mind with only 10,000 letters, we must be more powerful than we thought."
That was not what he wanted to hear.
Right. So that was it. So then the show, the show got renewed for the third season, but also more importantly, you became inextricably linked to the Star Trek story.
Yes.
And that led to your published work, which is of all of the Star Trek books that have been written, it has the coolest name of them all, the Star Trek Concordance, which is cooler than the Star Trek Compendium,
which is another cool book that
you did not work on.
No,
but they were clearly trying to get a name. Like, what's as cool as Concordance? I don't know. Compendium? Close,
exactly,
but no cigar.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Well, that came out right on top of my book, and it was quite obviously, he was... had been
and
dogging
were,
my footsteps.
Actually, there were parts of it that were wholesale lifted.
Oh, the Compendium just ripped off the Concordance?
I'm
going back home and burning my copy.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Each book that is put out in the dictionary or encyclopedia form certainly builds on another book, certainly builds on what has gone before. However, and they add things. People have their own agenda. People have their own viewpoint. And so each book is going to be different, as you well know by reading all of this stuff now.
I've got to say, Mike and Denise Okuda's book, he openly acknowledges the Concordance and what an aid it was to him in doing the much broader book.
What do you guys think of Memory Alpha online? Do you play around on there sometimes, or?
We actually don't spend a lot of time doing that, but I don't know about Memory Alpha, but we'll look it up.
Memory Alpha is a fan sourced. It's like Wikipedia, but it's Wikipedia just for Star Trek.
All right.
So it's fan sourced, and it is. I mean, it's just it does the one thing that a book can't do, which is if you were to print it out, it would be 7 zillion pages.
Right.
It's just every little thing has a link, and every alien species, every extra just notes and notes and notes and pages and pages and pages. It's definitely the next generation of a book, but you can't bring it with you to the beach. So that's a different.
That's wonderful because having the information on anything out there is more for the fans, whatever you're fans of, to read, and more information that is now literally part of the universe and will not ever be forgotten.
Right. And so the Concordance was not the very first Star Trek book, but it was the first Star Trek reference book, I think, published. And back then it was a different time. Was it a quote unquote officially licensed, or it sort of came it came out of like what looked like what mimeographs, and then were they actually mimeographs?
Or it was that actually mimeographs.
Mimeograph.
Tell the young people what mimeographs are, because they sure as heck don't.
It's essentially you type the information onto a stencil. It's a tissue sheet that's got wax on it, and the typewriter keys. Look up typewriters, kid. come up and strike this and make the impression for the letter. And then you put this on a machine that's got a big drum.
Yeah.
And inside the drum is ink. Look up ink.
Right. And you twirl it, right? You spin it around.
Spin it around.
John was the one who hand-cranked.
So you hand-cranked the Concordance in your garage, in the backyard,
basement.
Yeah,
and
did it hurt your hand? I mean, did you get sore after a while? Or you're like,
I tried to alternate arms.
Right, and as you're doing it, and it's going into the late hours, like I'm doing this for Captain Kirk. I'm serving the Federation by doing this.
No, I think it was just by that time. I'll tell you something. By that time, it'd become a force of itself.
Right,
and more fans wanted the book. We didn't do them all at once. It was basically sort of. began to be on demand, and we'd run off 100 or so at a time.
Wow.
Because, you know, for one thing, we had to get the money to get the paper and ink.
We sold them, you know, and we made enough money off of them that we could go with, we could then start doing them on offset press.
Okay, make somebody else crank them at that point.
Yeah, and offset what did very expensive to being affordable.
Yeah.
So we could do it.
What did it let, if we could go back in time to the late 1960s, what did you charge, if you remember, for a hand-cranked concordance?
Gosh, I don't remember. But I do remember that one young man wrote a violent objection to the charge, which was, by the way, very reasonable.
Probably like $3.
Five. And he said, so it averages out X amount of cents per page. And I don't feel that's a good value.
All right, make your own damn book.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay then, how about that? Yeah, we got a lot of rather wonderful and strange letters. And, you know, if we don't answer Star Trek's fan mail anymore, but we get, you know, we're online, we're on Facebook, and we get some really interesting things.
Yeah.
And loads of fun in some cases.
A man came up to us yesterday and asked us to autograph his copy of that original offset concordance, and he said I was in your house 40 some years ago and had to collate my own copy and this is it.
Oh, that's great.
We were shameless. I mean, our children, who could barely reach the top of the table, would collate the magazine and put it together, and, you know, instead of people, wow, kids that young. And I'm a big advocate of child labor, you know, especially when they work for ice cream.
Right. Or no ice cream if they don't do it, right?
Exactly.
So just for people who don't know what the concordance was, I mean, you got to remember, this was a time when the only people who had computers were NASA and that's it, and major universities. So it was primarily, although not exclusively, simply information, you know, just reference information about, you know, Starfleet, about the ships, about each episode. So Wolf in the Fold, you know, what was its star date? What's the synopsis? You know, what happens? And then information about the characters. So, like, you know, a little dossier on Scotty, a little dossier on Spock.
Right.
And then there also were some sketches, and there was some fan art.
We got fan art from a lot of fans, really delightful. And we are actually looking to get the concordance updated. We would put it online, and we're contacting the artist and to get their permission to use their art.
And I don't think had anything like this existed before. I mean, there had been, like, fan books. Like, there had been popular television shows, particularly for kids. Like, I don't know, the Howdy Doody show, whatever. They would have, like, a comic book that they would sell to the kids.
Had been something called the Index to Science Fiction Magazines.
But that was just for science fiction in general.
Right. Nothing for Star Trek at that
time. I mean, for other things that were beloved by fans, like Lord of the Rings, for example, was there ever a fan-created text that one could buy to just sort of...
Well, not before the concordance.
Yeah, I mean, this is really trailblazing stuff.
Yeah. Well, this is why we had to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
We shopped it around to some publishers, and nobody was interested. And then suddenly Ballantine, a publisher, got interested, and they published the first concordance.
What, the one that people could buy in stores?
The one with the wheel.
Yeah, no, explain this. The front of, and what year was this when Ballantine published that? That was
sometime in the middle 70s.
Middle 70s, okay. So the concordance was already a fan favorite, as we've discussed, the mimeograph version, but then one publisher got smart and said, hey, there's an audience for this.
Yes.
And they made it, you know, a little glossier, a little more professional looking, but the cover had like a wheel, I remember my mother used to have a phone book like this. It looked like a rotary dial.
Mm-hmm.
So
if
you had a friend whose last name started with L, you would then dial it to L, and the book would open at L. So the wheel on the front of your book, what did it do exactly?
It had the code letters for each of the episodes, so that you could wheel around and find that, and then find what page it was on. And by code letters, I mean, like, if the...
assignment Earth was AE.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And okay. So you knew to look for that because it had the list just inside the you know, book.
So you don't have to flip around. I mean, that, no, I mean no, that's, yeah. that's...
And also, the whole thing was not just a wheel. It was the hull of the Enterprise.
It's a saucer.
And, yeah. and okay. the book, the cover, was a wraparound Enterprise. Yeah. So you got the nacelles on the other side, on the back. And it was a very popular thing. People got, even when the little center gizmo that held the wheel in broke or fell out, they would put a brad in it, or they'd come up with some other way to keep that going. You know, it was kind of fun. And I'm very pleased when a fan brings up a well-used
right.
one, because this was not a fancy book to put on the shelf. And, you know,
it was a reference book,
and daily, you should use it as a reference.
You needed it for daily use. Yes, so, wait, exactly. I need to remember a fact yeah. about something. And, well, you know, I'll have you know, I did, because I knew that I was talking to you today, just mm-hmm. about an hour ago, I looked online, mm-hmm. and fans who are hearing about this for the first time, you can buy them for... you know, used,
right.
but for a relatively low fee.
Exactly.
The book with the wheel that we're talking about, you can find it for $6.
Really?
Yeah. And the
I'm glad that,
the
that
mimeograph
works.
One, I mean, it would be better if some of that money went to your pocket.
Yeah, but it doesn't, used, but you know.
That's not, at this point, you've given up on that.
Right.
But, and the original mimeographs, you can find them online for about $20.
and a typewriter, well, you know.
You know, so you can. I was. I do not own a copy of the original ones that we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. but I'm going to. I'm going to buy one today because I feel like I should have one.
In fact, we don't have a copy of that.
No, but you can get it for $20. So, I just looked this morning.
You know, yeah. But that's. You know, it's been a fun ride on that kind of thing. And now I'm working with a gentleman, Bob Littlepage in Colorado? Yes. Who is helping me put together an online
updated version,
simply because even though there are other versions other episodes and other shows of Star Trek, this was the first, and it's a piece of history now. And that's, yeah. you know, and who knew? Who knew things were going to right. become historic? Isn't that amazing? And so, you know, we decided we'd put it online.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. It's great. I mean, a lot of the fans here that have been around the franchise mm-hmm. a long time, they started with you guys. So, but then later, of course, and as sort of a thank you, when the motion picture eventually got made, was it Gene specifically requested to have you guys on set?
Yes.
There was the big shot in Star Trek the Motion Picture. And by the way, we did an episode of this podcast a few weeks ago devoted mm-hmm. exclusively to the motion picture. We talked about it for about 90 minutes. There's the big shot where Kirk is briefing everybody in that giant rec room.
Right.
And Gene said, I want a couple of people who deserve to be in this set. And it was you two and a dozen others.
A few others, and the fun part of it was all the costumes had already been made.
Yeah.
And they were made for women from 5'6" on up.
Uh-huh.
I'm 5'3".
Uh-huh.
So I'm the only person in the whole audience that has, I mean, a crew thing, that has a wrinkled uniform because I don't fit it. And by the way, I am not the little lady in the front row in the two-piece tan uniform.
Oh, people think you are, and that's not you.
That is Mrs. Robert Wise.
Ah, okay.
And you notice that her uniform fits?
Because he was going to hear about it afterwards.
Yes, indeed. But when we met, we looked at each other, and it was, you know, it's like we could be relatives.
Oh, wow.
You know, we're not identical, but we could be relatives. And So I said, you got some Irish in your background somewhere. And she said, yes.
Well, that's a heck of a victory lap, being officially in the in the crew there.
Well, so. John would have been, but his job was very heavy at that point, and he couldn't get free. And that was so terrible.
Curses.
Because see, originally they'd said it was going to be 2 days, because they figured with that many, about 140 fans on the deck, it would take longer to film than usual. Well, they wouldn't give John 2 days off. It turned out to be only 1 day. They could have fudged on that one. But we got to quitting time that day, and the director, Robert Wise, said, we're doing so well if we continue on right now, we can finish this whole job in today. And, well, none of the extras had any say on that. But, right. of course, we were all thrilled because we weren't being paid extra, by the way, and neither were the real extras.
Yeah.
But we were, you know, longer on the bridge set and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wrapped at about 11:30 at night.
Oh, wow, long day.
And I'll tell you, well, and we were all up at about 4 o'clock in the morning to begin with. My feet hurt clear up to my hat brim, and I was so tired I couldn't even go with some of them to the Mexican restaurant across the street for a margarita. I figured, you know, that would be it. And so, and we went home, and I don't even remember going to bed, you know. But boy, was that an experience.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Well, cool. Well, listen, but I do wanted to mention that I was, you know, reading, like I said, I was looking for your old books mm-hmm. online, and reading about your work, because you continue to work in costuming and makeup and films.
Oh, yes.
And you worked on some really fun films back in the day, in addition to Star Trek.
Yes,
I did. You know where I'm going with this, right?
I know where you're going with
it. You worked on the great softcore parody film Flesh Gordon.
I did.
Still sci-fi. Your love for sci-fi continues.
I did the makeup, and here's I had a lot of friends who actually were working in it, you know.
Yeah.
And a couple of them wouldn't admit it until a few years ago.
Oh.
Dennis Muren.
Yeah.
Oscar-winning cinematographer.
Worked on Flesh Gordon.
Worked on Flesh Gordon. Mike Miner, who later worked for Star Trek. And just some, you know.
But this was a tiny budget movie,
oh,
right?
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
But it became, for people who don't know, Flesh Gordon is exactly what it sounds like. It's a parody of Flesh Gordon, but it's a little bit risque. I mean, by today's standards.
By today's standards, you know.
It's very tame.
Really.
And it's very tongue-in-cheek. It's very funny. It's a goofy, it almost has like a Ray Harryhausen-style animation in it.
It almost is. And people, you know, it's like, the actor they hired to play Emperor Wang.
Emperor Wang, not Emperor Ming.
No, Emperor Wang.
John is cracking up.
He was allowed to just go over the hill with dialogue and everything and acting. And they wanted him to look like a 300-year-old drag queen. Mm-hmm. I quote the director. And
he was 23?
Yeah, he was
24.
About 20. Yeah, and I'm looking and thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do about that? And he said, I have a life mask. Yay, we're home free. So he brought it, and he was a doll. He put up with all this makeup that we had to put on him for this. And throughout the movie, he's getting older and stranger, and, you know,
they'd film.
Yeah.
And then she'd come home and make the prosthetics to put on him the next day. On that life mask.
Oh, wow.
And I was standing there while I'm doing this with a phone in my ear, a telephone, go look that up too, and talking to little Ricky Baker.
Whoa! Rick Baker.
Yes. Well, he had been at one of our conventions. We'd given him a room to do makeup in.
Yeah. So,
anyway, his mother wouldn't let him do this movie because he was too young.
He was a teenager.
I had never done prosthetic before. I just didn't tell anybody that. And so I phoned him and I said, oh, hon, walk me through this. And he did. He gave me the list of go down to get, and I got the stuff. And here I am. We've got the living room table covered with newspapers, and I've got the life mask, and I'm listening to him and creating. So, you know, I had a real crick in my neck when I was finished. But I do the prosthetics according to him.
Yeah.
And then he gave me all the instructions on application.
Wow.
And that was,
it a fun production or was it a rushed kind of time?
Oh, it was rushed, but it was fun. Yeah. I mean, it was terribly fun because the people just were, you know, they were romping through it.
Yeah.
You can tell that if you look at it. You
know? Oh, it's a very campy.
Oh, very. Yeah, and one of the great lines that Emperor Wang had is, you know, he was telling them, you know, well, the deep and dire things he was going to do. In the background are these girls tied down and being tickled with feathers, so innocuous, so silly.
Yeah.
And the sets were like virtually cardboard. And he slams out of the room, and not only does he catch the end of his cape in the doorway, but the whole set waggled. And there was this little silence, like, what do we do now? And he opens the door again, and he says, that goes for your little dog, too. And closes the door. And they left it in because it was just so silly, you know. Yeah. And that was the kind of thing that happened.
What was the premiere like? Was there a big premiere?
There was no big premiere. Now, you know, today there would have been, but right. in those days it just opened somewhere and that was about
right.
it.
And then it disappeared. But then it became something of a hit on VHS yeah. afterwards. Yeah. Everything you guys touch becomes a big hit later on.
And I wish, yes, I wish we were independently wealthy by now.
Where's our piece of the
right.
action?
Yeah, you know. And, you know, we get to go to conventions because they invite us,
right,
because
right.
we can afford it. So,
well, however, because yeah. of Star Trek,
yes,
we have been to conventions all over the United States,
yeah,
into Canada, to England, to Ireland,
oh yeah,
to Germany, to Australia, New Zealand.
Wow,
I mean, we've traveled a lot.
Yeah, and how yeah. many how many years have you been married?
56 years.
56 years. All right. Yeah. So you didn't make a fortune, but you've been married for 56 years.
And we have three great daughters.
Yeah.
And, you know, we may be just senior citizens on a fixed income, but we're pretty wealthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense. And also, the payoff for Star Trek has been that we have met so many wonderful people.
Yeah.
And some of them have become friends. We have a dear friend in Germany. She's a policewoman from Lüneburg and was a very big, still
she
is.
Was.
A very,
I think she retired.
Yeah, but a very big Star Trek fan. We went to Germany at one point for a convention. We'd extended our ticket, and she rented a van, loaded up Rex, her canine police dog, and off we went seeing a great deal of Germany, just vacation like you know.
Yeah, yeah. And that's because of yeah. Star Trek. You met these and
yeah.
the other day
Star
you were yesterday the other day you mm-hmm. were on stage and mm-hmm. people sprang to their feet. A hero's welcome.
What,
so.
What I mean, that was a big surprise and very pleasing. I mean, that's quite wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
And so yeah.
Well, again, I want to wrap it up here. I've taken up a lot of your time, but okay. Again, I mean, like I said, it takes a village to make Star Trek. Is there's not
it
one
does.
There's not one father, there's not one parent, but a lot of what we love about it really was dependent on the work that you guys did. And on a personal level, Star Trek has meant a lot to me over the years. So I can't thank you guys enough for what you did back then.
Thank you very
well, thank
much.
Thank you.
All right, you got it. And that's going to be it for this week's episode. Thank you so much, Anniversary Week here. Thank you to Bijo and John. Thank you also, Anniversary Week, to our last episode, Dave Schilling, for going on a deep dive with me on The Man Trap. We love Dave Schilling. And we'll be back soon with some more stuff, this time from Mission New York, the Star Trek convention at the Jacob Javits Center, where your host, that's me, did some fun live activities, and we're going to share them with you real soon here on Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.